folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. All right, today we're talking about transoxamic acid, TXA. If you have been keeping up with the trauma literature, you may have noticed there's an article published in The Lancet called Crash 2. It's the effects of transoxamic acid on trauma patients requiring blood transfusion, and it saved lives. And that was one trial. And now recently, the MATTERS trial was published, which is adding transoxamic to a military population as part of a massive transfusion. And again, mortality benefit. Yet most of the trauma centers in the U.S. are not doing this yet. So I figured I'd get one of the primary authors of Crash 2, Dr. Timothy Coates, on the podcast. Let's go right to it.
So my name's Professor Tim Coates. I'm Professor of Emergency Medicine here at the University of Leicester in the UK.
You wrote in regarding a lecture I had done about hemostatic resuscitation, and you had some additional thoughts to add on the Crash 2 trial, and you were particularly relevant for comments on that trial. Why don't you tell us your involvement with it?
So I've had an interest in coagulation following trauma for a number of years, and this led to some work looking at what's going on very early on after injury, and the idea then that maybe manipulating clot breakdown might be a way of improving patient outcomes.
Now this is fascinating to me because I don't think many people who aren't into the real depths of the coagulation of trauma really understand this. But it's not just a problem of not being able to make a clot, but even if you form a clot, that clot might be broken down by the patient's own body. Is that correct?
When we were at medical school, we were taught that coagulation system was a series or a chain of events that happened to form a clot. And like most things I was taught in medical school, that is entirely wrong. Perhaps the way to think about it is like, you know, one of those new fighter planes, modern fighter planes, they can't fly on their own. They've got a computer that's continually tweaking things, that's keeping the aircraft in balance. And there's a sort of network, a web of controls that's enabling that aircraft to fly. Coagulation system is exactly the same. It's a beautiful balance between the interactions between different molecules that are keeping the blood flowing, yet allowing to clot to happen when it's needed, but only when it's needed. It's a really complex web system.
How does transoxamic acid fit into this entire web and into the acute coagulopathy of trauma?
So transoxamic acid inhibits fibrinolysis. It stops clot breakdown. It's not a very powerful inhibitor of fibrinolysis. It isn't a sort of drug where you give it and the patient will stop bleeding in front of you and everything will be fine. But what you're doing is you're just slightly changing the balance within the coagulation system so that there's less breakdown of clot. Now, we don't really understand enough about those complex interactions to know exactly how this works. And the trial was based on guesswork and extrapolation from cardiac surgery rather than a real understanding of how the coagulation system works after injury.
And now the trial we're talking about, Crash 2, was quite large, quite extensive, and you had an intimate involvement. Why don't you tell us just a bit about the Crash 2 trial?
So the Crash 2 trial was a big trial. We randomized just over 20,000 patients. We did that in 274 hospitals in 40 different countries across the world. This was using a very pragmatic type methodology. There is a group at the School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the UK that specializes in doing large trials across many different countries. So it's the link between emergency medicine researchers and a group of researchers that are able to do that sort of work that's enabled the Crash 2 trial to happen.
So we had a pragmatic trial of transoxamic acid in Crash 2. Various levels of technological advancement in these trauma centers, and still, overall, the trial showed an absolute reduction in mortality of 1.5%. And what we could say from that is pretty much any trauma center this was applied in should see benefit in their patients. Would that be fair?
I think that's right, and we did some, once you get into subgroup analysis, numbers and power get smaller, we did some subgroup analysis looking at the different continents that people were randomized from, and the effects still seemed to be there. So it didn't really matter whether you're in a very highly advanced trauma system or not such an advanced trauma system, there still seemed to be a benefit from this intervention.
So let's get down to brass tacks now. How should we be taking the results of CRASH II and integrating it into the care of our trauma patients in the ED today?
So the patients that were randomized into CRASH II were patients who the physician treating them thought was bleeding or was at risk of significant bleeding. And we gave clinicians the sort of rule of thumb that by significant bleeding, we thought that meant blood might need a blood transfusion. So in the trial, we looked at patients that the physician treating them cross-matched or group and saved the patient when they came in. That's about the level. So I think that we ought to be applying that same criteria to emergency medicine practice. If you have a trauma patient who you think's got significant bleeding, like they're going to need a transfusion, then that's the sort of patient you ought to be giving tranexamic acid to as early as possible after their injury.
Now, in the actual CRASH II trial, when you looked at it in subgroup analysis, it seemed it was the sicker patients who got the most benefit. Would that be fair?
I'm not sure that that's quite the way that I'd interpret it. There is a question about which patients it should be given to. Now, we're working at the moment looking at a predictive model based on the trial data to see how much benefit you actually get. It did look as if for an individual patient, the sicker patients had more benefit. But of course, there's many fewer of that type of patient. So if you look on a population basis at all of your trauma patients, if you only give it to the sick patients, you're going to miss out a lot of that benefit. So a small benefit in a large number of patients with more moderate injuries equals more lives saved than a large benefit in the relatively few critically ill and bleeding patients.
Fair enough. So based on what you're saying, the second we think we're going to give a unit of packed cells, we should be thinking about giving the tranexamic acid.
Yeah, I think that's a good rule of thumb. Good rule of thumb to use. Now, this is a pragmatic trial, because we thought, what's the entry criteria for the trial? We thought long and hard about having a particular level of blood pressure, a particular pulse rate, a particular mechanism of injury, but we found actually we couldn't replicate that complex thing that the emergency physician is doing in the back of their brain that's evaluating the patient's level of risk. So it depends on the individual clinician saying, is this patient at risk of bleeding? Is it the sort of patient I'm going to need to transfuse? If you think it's the sort of patient that's going to bleed or is bleeding, then tranexamic acid is a good treatment for them.
Fair enough. And in CRASH II, it was an initial bolus infusion over 10 minutes of a gram, and then an additional continuous drip for the next 8 hours. Now, giving the bolus seems relatively easy in a trauma setting. The drip sometimes is tougher. We're giving a lot of blood products. We don't necessarily have multiple axes. In the actual ED setting and the early operative setting, if we just gave the bolus like they did in the recently published MATTERS trial, how much of the benefit do you think we're losing?
Tranexamic acid has got a big therapeutic window, which is why we can just give a gram to anybody and it doesn't really matter what size you are, it's the right dose for you. So most of the benefit probably comes early on. And if you look at the patients that really benefit, it seems to be the earlier the treatment is started, the more benefit there is. If you look at fibrinolysis after injury, it's all front-loaded. You know, D-dimer levels are highest in the pre-hospital phase following injury. They're already going down by the time you get to hospital. So I guess, if you ask me to guess, I'd guess that most of the benefit comes from the initial bolus, but I don't know, and we didn't test that. So if you really want to get the benefit for your patients that we found in the CRASH II trial, you need to try and stick as closely as possible to the what we did, which was 1 gram over 10 minutes. We just put a gram of tranexamic acid in a 100 ml bag of saline and just ran that in. The 10 minutes really doesn't matter. You don't need to put it in a pump or anything like that. And then we set up a gram in a 500 ml bag of saline or whatever crystalloid, and put that in the pump to run over about eight hours. If you interrupt that for a while, it probably doesn't matter. I probably wouldn't run it for longer than 8 hours because the acute phase response starts kicking in. The patient starts getting a bit more clotty at that phase, and you don't really want to probably to be giving an antifibrinolytic after about 8 hours from injury.
Fair enough. Now, when I had first spoken about this at ASEP, I had mentioned that there was no real difference in the amount of blood products that were transfused in either of these groups, which seemed a little bit puzzling, because you'd expect if this was preventing clot breakdown, there would have been less transfusions in the treated group. And this is what actually caused you to write to me about the difference between pragmatic and explanatory trials. So why do you think there was not a difference in the amount of blood products given?
So the primary outcome in this trial was survival. And if you have a very strong effect on the primary outcome, you get something called survival bias, which means the secondary outcomes are misleading. So basically, because we got so many extra survivors, they survived long enough to have blood products and blood transfusions. So if you get a lot of extra survivors in the intervention group, you're going to mask any effect on the volume of blood products given, because those additional survivors will probably get quite a lot of blood and blood products. So the intervention group, the amount of blood and blood products used goes up in that group because of those extra survivors. So I think it's just very difficult to interpret the secondary outcomes when you've got a very big effect on the primary outcome.
Absolutely. That makes complete sense. And it's kind of the opposite situation of the problems we're having with the ratios of transfusion between PRBCs and FFP. That same survivor bias is creeping in and making the data very difficult to interpret.
Absolutely. Particularly if you get your FFP later than your red cells, because it's got to be thawed and that sort of thing, then it's only people that survive long enough that get the FFP, so the ratios are very difficult to interpret.
Absolutely. Now let me tease this out, because it seems right now we're giving transexamic empirically to, we believe, prevent that clot breakdown, that fibrinolysis, and it might also have some other effects. There's a role possibly for an anti-inflammatory effect, is that correct?
Absolutely, and there's a really interesting interaction between coagulation and inflammation really early on. There's a lot of molecules in common between those two systems. Again, really interesting stuff that we don't really understand.
Now, if we did believe that it's working by blocking that fibrinolysis, there actually are tests now we could be doing in the trauma bay to actually find out if the patient's breaking down their clot. Tests like Rotem or TEG. Are you folks using that? Are you looking at transexamic and its relation to those tests?
So I think these tests are perhaps causing some people to misinterpret the result of the CRASH II trial. The TEG will show whether the pattern of clot formation and clot breakdown is normal or not. So there is also certainly a condition of pathological hyperfibrinolysis, which you will find using a whole blood coagulation assay such as the TEG, which occurs perhaps in 5% of patients with an injury severity score greater than 15. Now, I'm not sure that tranexamic acid in the CRASH II trial was having its effect by reversing pathological hyperfibrinolysis. I think what it was doing was just changing the normal balance within the coagulation system of clot formation and clot breakdown. So I'm not sure that the TEG is helpful. It will identify pathological clot breakdown, But it were, if there's normal clot breakdown going on, that's just what the TEG will show, is normal clot breakdown. So I'm not sure that we've quite got what the TEG is showing us. And it may well be that altering fibrinolysis may be of an advantage to the patient, even if the TEG looks normal.
Interesting. So the idea would be, and it makes sense that because there would probably be a much lower treatment effect if it was only in that rare circumstance of hyperfibrinolysis, that perhaps any degree of fibrinolysis in these patients may not be to their advantage. So transoxamic acid's being given to all of them. But we did actually, when we saw on the TEG that circumstance of hyperfibrinolysis, that's when we were giving Amicar at the trauma center in an attempt to actually counter that.
Yeah, and that's the way in cardiac surgery, for example, you know, TEGs have been used for many years. And if you have a hyperfibrinolytic pattern on the TEG, you probably would benefit from having an antifibrinolytic drug. But I think you're making a big mistake if you only give it to the patients that have pathological hyperfibrinolysis. I think you're missing out a big chunk of the benefit, and I would think more than half of the benefit is being missed if you restrict it just to those patients.
That's a fantastic point. Now, what about Amicar? Because most of the places in the United States have aminocaproic acid on their formularies, and folks have not gotten transoxamic acid. It's kind of died out when they were using it in GYN and cardiac surgery. Is it interchangeable? Do we know?
No is the answer. We obviously, when we started the CRASH II trial, we had, you know, three antifibrinolytic agents at that time, which we had to make a decision between. I'm very glad we didn't choose to use a protonin, because that would have screwed the trial up halfway through when it was withdrawn. We decided on tranexamic acid because there's more, if you look at the literature, there's quite a lot more literature around tranexamic acid than aminocaproic acid. And certainly with a UK-based trial, we'd be much more familiar with tranexamic acid here. Would it have the same effect? I think, again, that's probably, your guess is as good as mine. We didn't test it. We don't know. I would think it probably would have the same effect, but there's going to be some uncertainty on that.
Fair enough. Well, what's next? What are you folks looking at now to better elucidate what's going on with transoxamic acid and coagulopathy of trauma?
So the next trial that's going on is the WOMAN trial, which is not in trauma, because if you look at other patient groups that are hyperfibrinolytic, postpartum hemorrhage is a bleeding hyperfibrinolytic state. If you look worldwide, it is a huge cause of maternal mortality. So the woman trial of randomizing patients with postpartum hemorrhage to receive early dosing with tranexamic acid has already randomized over 1,000 patients, starting mainly in East Africa. The next trial that we're looking for funding for at the moment is we looked at a subgroup within CRASH II, which was the head injured patients. We excluded isolated head injury from the CRASH II trial because of some of the negative results in medical subarachnoid hemorrhage and antifibrinolytic agents. But if you look at the head injured patients that were in the CRASH II trial and look at expansion of hematomas, there is less expansion of the hematomas inside the head in patients that were giving tranexamic acid. Now, there weren't enough patients to make that statistically significant or anything, but it's an interesting indication of maybe we should be looking at bleeding inside the head as well as bleeding elsewhere.
I'll just make a quick insert here. Any of you who've heard me talk about subarachnoid, perhaps at ACIP, know that I, and I think many of the neurointensivists out there, are actually giving an antifibrinolytic for our subarachnoid patients. The old data did show problems. The new data for short-term use, not leaving them on this drug for a week, but only for a few hours until they get their aneurysm definitively managed, is actually a good thing. We're using aminocaproic acid in all of our aneurysmal subarachnoids right now. Fantastic. If there's Anything else you'd like to add and tell the listeners? Now is the time, Dr. Coates.
No, I think that's a good discussion. It's an interesting thing to look at. It's going to be an area where I think there's going to be a lot more interest and a lot more coming out over the next few years.
Fantastic. Well, I thank you so much for your time. So how do we sum this all up? Transexamic is cheap. We're talking $100 a gram in the United States, at least at our hospital. In Great Britain, it seems like it's ridiculously cheap, something like the equivalent of less than $10, and it saves lives. Now, probably the greatest benefit is seen in those who are hypotensive or really sick, but if you only gave it to those patients, according to Dr. Coates, you'd be missing out on a lot of the benefit over a much broader population. His contention, you should be giving it to any patient requiring blood transfusion and trauma. You should get that first gram in, which is over 10 minutes, as soon as possible. When you have the time, start the infusion. If you want to get the exact same situation as they had in the CRASH II trial, the MATTERS trial will tell us that intermittent boluses would work as well. I don't see any reason not to be giving this. There was no thrombogenic side effects in the enormous population of the CRASH II trial. It's not being done. It probably should be done. Start doing it. Get the trauma folks, the critical care folks, the ED folks, and the hematology folks in a room and parse this out. That's what we're doing right now. What else? Well, I had a little bit, another couple minutes on the difference between pragmatic and explanatory trials with Dr. Coates. I put that in the show notes because we were running over on time. It's there for you if you're interested, and you should be because this is really interesting stuff. So that's there. The other thing is I realize I haven't really mentioned this for a long time, but I have another website called crashingpatient.com. That's one word, crashingpatient.com, which is my web textbook. If you haven't ever seen that, you should go over and check that out because I think there's a lot of good stuff there. It's friggin' enormous and it's free. So Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.